Well, good evening. Good evening. Good evening and welcome. Hopefully you're well fed and watered. My name's Andrew Satch. I'm on the leadership team here at St. Helens. And this evening's going to be in two parts. We have an interview first, and then I'll be giving a talk a little bit later on. But firstly, would you put your hands together to welcome our guest, Sir Jeremy Cook.
Well, that's a novel experience.
You're not normally applauded when people meet on a stage in the courtroom. Now, Jeremy is a retired High Court judge, has had a long and very interesting career, which is still going on. I asked him what he was doing today, and it was something to do with a Bollywood film scandal, but he can't say more because the case is ongoing. But he's got lots of stories to tell us, and the aim is we'll find out a little bit about him and his life and a bit about his Christian faith and his perspective on this question: could life in this world be different? But I want to start by asking a question about your association with this church, which I believe goes back to your time on your gap year when you were given the responsibility of parking the rector's car.
Yeah, well, that wasn't my main responsibility. My main responsibility was making sandwiches and putting out the chairs. But one of the things I was given to do was to take the rector's car. It was a lovely new Mini. And these in the days when Minis were new and parking meters were new. And what you weren't allowed to do was to feed the meter, so you couldn't leave your car there and keep putting money in. So my job, take the rector's car, drive it around the block, find another meter, and put money in the meter. Very naive, I come back and I put money in the wrong meter. End result is a big fine for the rector. And I say, well, of course, doing the right thing. I say, well, you better take that out of the pittance of pocket money that I get from the vicar I'm working for up the road. But unfortunately, the fine was much greater than my monthly figure. So that was that. But they were very gracious about it.
There was no court appearances at that
stage? No court appearances, no.
Now, this isn't the only time that you've been unpopular as in your career in the law, later in the law. And I understand that you've been so unpopular that you have the rare distinction of having had an effigy of you burnt on two separate occasions.
This is true.
Tell us about each of those.
Well, I've been burnt in effigy twice. And basically, I say, as long as it's only an effigy, that's fine. But once was in Karachi, and those of you who are followers of cricket may remember the Pakistani team who were involved in spot-fixing of cricket matches in this country. And I presided over the trial, and they were duly convicted, and I therefore sent them to prison.
You said they weren't. One of them wasn't very good at it.
Well, he was a youngster. He wasn't an experienced fixer. The other chap was a much more experienced man at it. If anybody had watched this, I don't know if you remember this, you could see it on film, and they were bowling no balls at a set time so people could gamble on it in the Far East. And this lad, he overstepped the mark by about a yard and a half. So it was blatantly obvious to all the world. And we had to cut the commentary from the television because Ian Botham, Sir Ian Botham, bless him, said, "My, that was a big one." So there we are. So that's accounted for my unpopularity in Pakistan, in Karachi.
So your job was to watch cricket on the TV?
Well, at the time I was running the South East Circuit, and it's the only case that I actually said, I'm going to hear that one. If anybody's going to be paid for watching cricket, it'll be me.
So tell us why they burnt an effigy of you, just because they were unhappy with the outcome.
Yes, they thought this was a bad thing to do. I mean, I think if I went to India, I'd be very popular, but there we are.
So effigy in Karachi, and no one will guess where the other one was, but I believe it was in Lewes in Sussex.
In Lewes in Sussex, yes. What they do in Lewes is they have a great big bonfire night, and there are 9 bonfire societies. And the practice is for these societies to have a float, which they start making on November the 6th of the previous year, so they get it ready in time. And they pick unpopular people to burn. So sometimes it's, more often than not, it's politicians, It's been bankers quite a lot recently, people who are generally in the public news and not popular at the time. And the reason in this case was that I'd tried a manslaughter case, a rather nasty case, where people were running a fireworks factory, and they had in their fireworks factory military explosives. So they shouldn't actually have had these. Explosives were categorized, as some of you may know, into different classes, and they had class one explosives. And they brought one of these into court. It was called a mortar, and it looked just like a cartoon bomb. It was this size, the fuse on the top, and you expected to see the word bomb written on the side. But at all events, they had a number of these, and the factory caught fire. And firemen came to put it out. And the owners of the factory didn't tell the firemen what they had. And there was the most enormous explosion. And two firemen were blown to pieces. Literally blown to pieces. but what I didn't know when they were convicted and I sent these chaps to prison was that they were the major patrons of one of the bonfire societies. So while they were languishing in prison, their mates burned the judge. So there we are. So, better men than I have been burnt.
You've had quite a varied career. So we heard about your legal career. We'll come back to that in a minute. You also had a rugby career. So you played for Oxford back in the days when the Blues team could actually beat the South African side.
We did indeed.
And
we beat South Africa in 1969, yes, which is almost impossible to conceive of these days. It was an amateur game in those days. But
What was your trophy for beating the Springboks?
Well, they had a Springbok head. The Springbok team used to take a Springbok head around with them and give them to the first side which defeated them on tour. And more often than not, they took it home with them, in reality. But on this occasion, a few little lads managed to do the job.
So did you have the Springbok head in your Oxford rooms?
It was in the club rooms, yes.
Great. Now, you said that was your greatest success in rugby. You went on to play for Harlequins when it was before it was professional.
Yeah.
But you also asked me to ask you about your least successful.
I don't think I asked you to ask that. I thought you would. I think my most humiliating experience was at Twickenham. Harlequins used to play at Twickenham for the first half of the season, big Twickenham. In those days. I think it was the first or second game of the season. And we were playing Llanelli, who were a very strong side at the time. Wales was the dominant side in the late 60s and early 70s when I was playing. And a man called Derek Quinnell, who was an international and played for the Lions, who's the father of Scott Quinnell, who some of you may have watched playing more recently, and uncle of one of the other Quinnells there. Famous rugby-playing family. But he got the ball in some loose situation, and I went in courageously to tackle him and was absolutely squashed. He walked straight through me in the Jonah Lomu style, put the ball down under the posts at Twickenham, and there I was battered and bleeding on the ground. And I think it was the most humiliating experience I've ever had. Terrible.
Excellent. Now... The strapline for this week of talks is, could life in this world be different? Some people may have seen the promo film we've been running, or you might have seen some clips from it just there on the screen, of some of the horrific bits of newsreel footage just in the last few years that tell us that something's wrong with the world that we live in. And tonight our title is Truth in a Deceptive World. And I guess it's possible that we live a sheltered life and things are pretty easy for us individually. I guess as a judge, you've seen more of the ugliness of human life and human character than most of us. Give us a taste of what life is like in the UK as you've seen it.
Well, it depends how grisly you want to be. Basically, I'm a commercial lawyer, so I'm a commercial judge. But one of the things you have to do when you go on the bench is to try murders. So I've tried a lot of murders in my time. And so one has seen a great deal of the uglier side of life, excuse me, in terms of drug wars and murders committed in that context, and family situations that go wrong, all sorts of situations of that kind.
You were telling me earlier of a case about 4 or 5 years ago where the issue of truth and deception and Christian faith all came together. Do you want to tell
well,
me about
yes,
that?
It's quite an unusual case, really, because this was a case that involved a man who was trying to find his wife, who he had been battering, and she'd constantly been running away from him and seeking to hide. And she finally got away from him and was hidden somewhere that he didn't know. And so he decided what he'd do is he'd kidnap the brother of his wife and torture him to find out where his estranged wife was. And he arranged for a kidnapping to take place in the East End of London. In fact, he got two lads, 18-year-olds, I think they probably were, just last year at school. And he engaged them to come in a car with him and to kidnap this individual, whom they then took back to a flat in the East End and tortured. And the lads were paid off. They didn't do any of the torturing bit. They simply did the kidnapping. And when they did the torturing, I don't know whether they simply overdid it or whether the man wouldn't talk, but in the end they killed him. And in what has become quite a commonplace these days, they then chop up the body. I hope you've got strong stomachs. The body is cut into half, put into carpets, and taken down to the place where one of the accomplices works, a butcher's shop. And then they chop the body into little pieces. And the body is taken to the Thames and thrown in the Thames. And the way it all comes to light is that about a mile and a half away, there's a security man standing outside an office block. And he's standing there minding his own business when a seagull flies overhead and drops something. And he goes out into the car park, and I can see a gentleman here has worked out what it is. It was a thumb. It was the thumb of the victim, who was known to the police from his fingerprints. They'd known he was missing. They found the thumbprint, and they gradually pieced together what's gone on. Well, various people are arrested. There's the husband, there's his brother, there's a brother-in-law, there's the two lads. There are about five or six of them. And they all tell the police various versions of events that have little or nothing to do with the truth, as you might expect. But come the day when they appear in court, the prosecution does its case, 2 or 3 weeks of it, and then one of the two lads comes to the witness box to give his evidence. And the first thing he says, having taken the oath, is this. He says, "I've sworn an oath to tell the truth on the New Testament, and that's what I'm going to do." And much to the surprise of everybody, he did. And that was, of course, sold all the other people down the river. It sold him down the river, so he was convicted of kidnapping. I was able to take a bit off the sentence because he had confessed, albeit at the last moment. But he went to prison. But what emerged was that he'd had a mother who was a Christian who had been praying for him for years. And during his time in prison, after arrest and before trial, he'd stopped and had a bit of a think about life. And during that time, he'd either come back to faith or certainly come to faith. So he felt he had to tell the truth. And he did. And as he went to prison, I was able to put him in touch with a Christian group in prison. And he's going on in the Christian faith, and he's probably out by now, out of prison. Mm. So that was an unusual story where terrible, terrible events, in fact, turned this young man's life around.
Now, we know that truthfulness is a Christian ethic. Jesus told his followers not to lie to each other. And here's an example, I guess, of that really affecting someone's life. But I guess there'll be people here who are thinking, how do we know that the New Testament itself is true? We're in a cynical culture. People make up stories. You hear lots of tall stories. What is it that persuades you, as somebody who spent his life sifting evidence and evaluating evidence, that your Christian faith is actually based on truth and isn't just a made-up story, fairy story?
Well, it's a question, isn't it, of looking at the evidence, to put it very broadly. What I say to juries, or what I used to say to juries, was you just look at the the facts as to what people have said has taken place, and you evaluate for yourself whether this makes sense. You take your experience of life, look at the observable facts, and then reach a common sense conclusion on what the explanation is. And you search out the truth by looking at the evidence and seeing what the most coherent explanation is. And looking at the world as we have it, you've got to find a coherent explanation for the way the world is, for the way people are, for aspirations to good and tendencies to evil, for the muck in life that we see, and yet the possibility of transformation and all the things that we value in life. I mean, take justice. That's a very good example, isn't it? I spend a lot of time talking about justice. Justice doesn't make any sense, does it, if you have a world that is entirely here by chance? What's the point of justice? And yet all of us instinctively know that justice matters. The basic cry of a child, it's not fair, it's not fair. And the parents say, well, life isn't fair, is it? But instinctively, we all know it shouldn't be like that. Now, why is that? If Dawkins is right, the selfish gene, survival of the fittest, all the rest of it, why on earth do we have these inclinations towards justice and morality and goodness and so on? But we all do. So you've got to explain these things and come up with some conclusion. And above all, what you've got to do is come up with some conclusion about Jesus. Who was he? What was he here for? What did he do? Take the evidence about what people said he did, the people who saw him, the people who heard him. Evaluate it for yourself.
Someone might come back and say, fair enough, okay, so let's look at what this person did. But when the claims of what he did are so extraordinary, so, you know, people say that Jesus died on a cross and then came back from the dead. That, you know, that's a really, really unusual, if not impossible, thing. Now, recently I was with you in a pub in Greenwich, and I watched you...
Don't tell everybody.
I watched you eat a daffodil in front of the assembled company. And you were worried that I was going to produce one now, but apparently you have, over your career, eaten really quite a few daffodils.
I have, yes.
And you advised that if anyone wants to do the same trick, that the yellow flower is safe, the green stem will take you to a hospital.
So don't eat the stalk. Don't eat the stalk.
Why did you do that, Jeremy?
Well, it's really just an illustration of evidence. I think I first did this for a group of kids in a church. And I said to the kids, now, if you go home and you tell your parents, the man up front in church ate a daffodil, your dad will say, don't be silly. You're having me on. And then you say, well, supposing you and your sister went home and a group of your friends, who your father knows are honest, reliable, likely lads, he might take a bit more notice. And then suppose 500 people turned up and they all said he'd eaten a daffodil. Well, that's evidence, you see. It's what people say they saw, because people who give evidence in court simply say what they saw or heard. You evaluate it, and you say, well, it seems very unlikely, but what are the alternative explanations? And in the case of the resurrection, it's very hard to come up with any sensible alternative. One of the most obvious things is that when one looks at what was being said at the time and the story that the Jews were putting around even 160 years later, we can tell from the dialogue of Trypho with Justin, the body was stolen, they say. Everybody knew that the grave was empty. And you come and say, body stolen? Is that a sensible explanation of circumstances? No doubt you can deal with this at greater length. Plenty of books on the subject, get hold of them. Reliable evidence for the resurrection.
Now, you've obviously been a convinced Christian for many years, and you have reasons and rational evidence that persuade you of that. Can I just ask what difference it makes to you practically in your life to believe in Jesus? So what difference does it make to you as a husband and a father? What difference does it make to you in your career? These are things you believe to be true, but so what? What's the practical outcome?
Well, the so what outcome is the motivation for what I do. So in terms of being a father, in terms of being a grandfather, as I know it, a husband, a judge, all of that is done to try and please God, to serve God. That's the basic difference, so that people looking at what I do as a judge wouldn't be able to see necessarily any difference on the outside between what I do and what a non-Christian judge does. We're all trying to do justice. But the motivation is entirely different, and I've got a reason for doing it that I think most judges who aren't Christians don't have. Back to that question we were asking ourselves a little while ago. You know, why does justice matter? And yet we all know that it does. To me, it makes sense to matter. Yeah. But if you don't believe in a God, and a God of justice, it doesn't make any sense to matter at all.
We're going to be looking, or I'm going to encourage people to look at this Gospel of Luke a bit later on. You told me earlier your favourite parable of Jesus from this little book.
My favourite story is one that Jesus told, which you'll find in Luke. It's the story of a bad judge. I don't know if you remember this story, but it goes a bit like this. Jesus says, in this town, there's a judge, and he's cynical, he's hard-bitten, he's world-weary, he's seen it all. He doesn't care about truth, he doesn't care about justice, he doesn't care about the Ministry of Justice or the Lord Chancellor. He's just sitting and waiting his time out till he can take up his index-linked pension. Now much reduced, I have to tell you. At all events, he's not troubled about doing what's right and justice at all. But there's this widow in the town, and she's been cheated. She can't afford lawyers. She can't afford to pay bribes, if the judge was interested in that, which we don't know. But she keeps pestering him. She wants her case dealt with. He can't be bothered with it. And he dismisses her time after time after time. But because she keeps coming back. In the story, we're told that Jesus says he got so fed up with it that he said, though I don't care about goodness and truth and justice and so on, I don't care about this woman. I won't get any peace unless I have her case dealt with. And so we're told he was shamed into doing it. He lifts her case and he gives her justice. And the conclusion that Jesus draws from this is this. He says, if that's what a corrupt, cynical, world-weary judge does, the one thing you can be absolutely certain of is that a just God will do justice one day and will get it 100% right. And that is a hugely comforting factor, because judges make mistakes, juries make mistakes, there are miscarriages of justice. But we've got a God who's interested in justice, and he will one day put everything to rights.
So, Jeremy, thank you very much for sharing some of your story with us. Let's see. We're going to take a 5-minute break now if you need to recharge your glasses, and then be back in your places, and I'll be giving a short talk for the next 20 minutes or so. Thank you. Please take your places, and we're going to resume our evening. Let me call us back together. Thank you again for coming to this series of evenings where we're addressing the question, could life in this world be different? We've heard from Jeremy about some of the ugliness of life in this world. We've seen on the screen some instantly recognizable images from the newsreels over the last few years that tell us that not everything in this world is attractive, not everything in this world is as it ought to be. Do we have grounds for being optimists, for hoping in something different or better? And in particular, this evening we're asking the question, have we got any grounds for finding truth in a world of deceit and lies? We heard that amazing story about the young man, the 18, 19-year-old, who, because of his Christian faith, spoke the truth in the witness box and got sentenced for doing so. Well, what I want to do this evening, my aim is quite simple. I want to persuade you to take one of these little books on your table, and in the next 25 minutes or so, I'm going to try and persuade you that this is worth reading. And that's really my only aim. I hope you'll leave here with the conviction, I ought to read this. Because in this book is the key to a different kind of life in this world, what Christians call the kingdom of God, or the kingdom rule of Jesus, a different kind of world, a true world, a hopeful world, a united world, a meaningful world. But of course, immediately we're suspicious because we want to know, isn't this just wishful thinking? We would like there to be a better world. And so Christians are just naive, gullible people who've persuaded themselves that what they would like to be true perhaps could be true in some far-off, distant fairy story. Well, I think the contrary, and I want to persuade you to the contrary in the next few minutes. I want to begin with a thought experiment that needs you to close your eyes, just momentarily. Would you close your eyes, please, and open them again now? I want you to imagine that you've just regained consciousness. There's a small pinprick in your arm where they put the needle in, but you don't remember it. In fact, the drug is so powerful that you remember nothing at all. Your memory has been completely erased. And everyone else in this room is in the same position. Let's say, for the sake of argument, we can still remember how to speak English. But otherwise, we've no recollection of anything beyond about 20 seconds ago. Imagine as well that these windows are boarded up on the outside, concreted in. The door over there is closed and locked. Here we are in this room with no memory of how we got here and no knowledge of anything outside or beyond our present experience. But being resourceful, people will begin to ask questions. What are we doing here in this room? How did we get here? How should we behave while we're here? Are there any ethical standards that ought to rule our behavior? Could we ever leave? If so, where would we go? What is life like beyond? Or maybe somebody even comes up with the question, puts on some talks in the room saying, could life in this room be different? But we don't know. Some people take the scientific approach. This was my own background as a scientist and an atheist. And they say, well, let's just do experiments to discover how life works in the room. So people carry some chairs up the stairs into the balcony and drop them off the balcony and measure it with their stopwatch, the acceleration due to gravity, 9.8 meters per second for every chair in the building. They come up with a theory of universal gravitation. Other people take things a step further and they start research into biology. They drop the chairs from the balcony onto people's feet and notice that you yelp with pain, and they measure the time taken between the chair landing on your foot for the first audible cry of discomfort, and they formulate a theory of nerve conduction and the speed at which the action potential travels up your leg. Other people notice that those on whose feet the chairs are dropped become angry and upset with the scientists doing the experiments, and they form a theory of sociology and how we behave as a group and how perhaps we ought to be ethical in the way that we do our experiments. And so simply by observing life within the room, we can understand various things about it. But when it comes to the question of life outside, the scientist says, look, this is beyond our experiments. So let's just assume that life in the room is all that there is. And they're content with that and what they can know about here and now. And other people have eaten rather too many of the delicious prawn canapes, and they fall into a prawn-induced seafood sleep and have a dream. They wake up and think, I think I've seen a vision. We're all part of a vast shoal of prawns swimming towards the great ocean or whatever it might be. And they persuade some people by their dream that they've been in contact with a deeper principle behind life in the room. But really, we're very limited. We're partly guessing, we're doing experiments that only reach so far, and we don't know any more. Imagine at that point, there's the sound of a bolt drawing back in a door, and the door over there opens and somebody comes in. Let's say it's somebody from the City of London Police, and they say, it's obvious what's happened here. You've come to an evening hosted by St. Helens Bishopsgate, and they've drugged you all. Get out now, whatever it is. Now, in my thought experiment, it's obvious, isn't it, that that person, what that person has to say, coming as they do from outside the room, takes precedence over what we know within the room. That they know more than our experiments know. They know more certainly than our dreams and our hunches suggest. They've got real answers, real truth about life from outside. And the claim is, the Christian claim is, that 2,000 years ago, somebody walked through the door of history from outside The Lord Jesus Christ, born in a stable, people know the Christmas story, was in fact the God who made this world step through the door of history. And he had answers. He had truth. He knew more than we know about life. And he had news about a better kind of life. Could life in this world be different? He said, yes. And he persuaded a lot of people. This is the tricky bit. He persuaded a lot of people at the time that he was God from outside. So some people were around as he walked through the door. They saw the angels in the sky proclaiming his birth. But others encountered him and met him later in his life when he was about 30, 31, 32 years old. And from what they witnessed, from what he did, from what he said, they concluded that they had met God, who was from outside. And you can read their testimony in this book. Now, I hope even that is enough to persuade you that you really ought to read this book. That's my aim for tonight. This book contains the testimony of people who met Jesus, who were themselves persuaded they had met God. Let me just open this book. Please grab one and open it. We're going to look at various little excerpts to give you a flavour. Open it at page 3, which is paradoxically the first page. And let me read the introduction. I wonder how you would expect a religious book to begin. This is part of the Bible. It's an account of Jesus' life. Would you expect it to begin? Here is a book about things that we feel that make us feel happier about this grim world. Here is a book about a beautiful vision of what would be lovely. And some of us have managed to persuade ourselves that it's true. Now, it doesn't start like that. Look at how it begins.
The very first chapter,
page 3, chapter 1. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who were from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught. So Luke, the writer, his ambition is that this patron of his, Theophilus, would be certain about Christian claims. And his methodology to bring about that certainty is to investigate from the eyewitnesses what they saw and heard, and to put it in order in this orderly narrative. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? It's not just in the 21st century, in the law courts, that we recognize the importance of first-hand eyewitness evidence. Actually, Luke recognizes that as well. And what he said he's done is to interview those who are around contemporaries of Jesus and to put their witness statements together in this volume. Luke himself wasn't an eyewitness of Jesus. Two of the other gospel writers were. John and Matthew were members of Jesus' band of 12. But Luke and Mark were associates of them around at the same time. And here is his compiled narrative. Now, you might be cynical. You think, look, how do I know this isn't just made up? Let me try to persuade you in three brief arguments. Firstly, this is not the story that you would make up if you were making up a religion. I mean, people have made up religions. Scientology is a great example. Ron Hubbard became a very rich man because of his designer Hollywood religion. And I think it's pretty obvious he made it up. But if you were making up a religion, you wouldn't make up this one. Let me explain why. And you don't need to look at these pages, but just to whet your appetite, on page 65, you will find, don't bother turning it, I'll summarize it for you. You'll find Jesus being asked the key political question of his day. Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, you may know that Jesus lived in Israel at the time of a Roman occupation. Roman soldiers marched the streets. They were incredibly unpopular with the Jewish native population. And so people asked Jesus, should we kowtow to these oppressors who have us under their thumb? They sought a revolutionary, actually. They wanted Jesus to light the fuse, to blow the powder keg, to launch a bloody revolution. But Jesus said famously, whose face is on the coin, they say, was Caesar's. Jesus says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. In other words, I'm not bothered if you want to pay your taxes in these little bits of metal to a Roman governor. See, Jesus wasn't the political revolutionary that everybody sought. That was the story that you would write. Instead, Jesus speaks of a kingdom that's not of this world and tells his followers to be good, peaceable citizens and even to endure oppression unjustly under their regime. Very unpopular. It's not the story that people wanted to read. Turn to page 73, you'll find the famous story of Peter denying Jesus. That famous prediction that Jesus made, Peter, before the cock crows, twice, you will deny me three times. And we read of the story, Peter's being interviewed by a servant girl in a courtyard. You know this guy, Jesus, don't you? I don't, he says. No, I'm sure you do. You've got the same accent. I do not know him, he says. And three times, he's such a coward that before a servant, he will not admit even to an association with Jesus during his trial. And he breaks down and weeps. Peter is a failed leader, a weak man. Now, of course, we know, don't we, at the moment, that leadership is all important in the contest between Jeremy and Mrs. May. That the question is, who's a credible, strong leader, strong and stable? Peter's not strong and stable. But Peter became the leader of the early Christian church. It's not the story that you'd make up about your leader if you wanted to give him credibility. It gets worse. You turn over a couple more pages, page 76, you find Jesus, the one that they believed to be God, now being executed on a Roman cross. And he doesn't look very much like God as he dies in weakness. In fact, they even mock him, saying, come on, if you're the king, save yourself. And he doesn't. And he dies. We know from literature from the first and second century that the crucifixion of Jesus was the stumbling block to people believing in him. How ridiculous the idea that you think this guy's God and yet he dies as a criminal. There's even a piece of graffiti famously from the third or fourth century found at the Palatine Hill in Rome. The graffiti shows a Christian bowing before Jesus and Jesus is depicted on a cross with the head of a donkey. The inscription reads, Alexamenos worships his God. As if to say, how foolish of Alexamenos, this Christian, to worship somebody who dies in this weak way. But of course, Jesus doesn't stay dead. And on page 77 of this book, we find the story of Jesus' empty tomb that Jeremy was referring to. And the first witnesses to the empty tomb were women. Now, that wouldn't bother us in our enlightened age, but in that time, a woman's testimony was not considered valid in court. So if you're making up the story, don't make the witnesses to your most significant turning point some women who no one's going to listen to. In fact, when they try and say the tomb's empty, we read, the words seemed to them like an idle tale, and they didn't believe them. Just women's talk, they thought. Because we're not as sexist as that, but they were. And this isn't how you would make up a story if you were writing. It's not the story you would make up. Nor is it the story, I think, that you could make up. At least you couldn't get away with making it up. Because we find in this book that Luke is a stickler for names and places and dates. Let me give you an example. Turn to page 11. Just an example. Chapter 3 down there on page 11. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John the son of Zechariah in the wilderness. And he went into all the region around the Jordan, proclaiming a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. You see, it's more specific than you need to be if you're just telling a fairy story. Just say, someone came saying you should be forgiven. Don't tell us exactly who's in government and exactly who this man was. Actually, the archaeology geeks amongst you will enjoy reading up on some of the inscriptions that have since been uncovered and how Luke gets absolutely correct all of the names, even of minor officials within the Roman court throughout his writings. But it's not just who was on the throne, who was in government at the time. It's also who things happened to. Page 30. Bottom of page 30. Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him. They were waiting for him. There came to him a man named Jairus, who was ruler of the synagogue. Falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, because he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. Look down to the third paragraph, verse 49. While he was still speaking, someone came from the ruler's house and said, "Your daughter's dead. Don't trouble the teacher anymore." But Jesus, on hearing this, answered, "Don't fear, only believe, and she will be well." I mean, this is a shockingly irresponsible thing to say, isn't it? It's like the worst of the American televangelists. To give false hope to grieving parents as their daughter lies dead next door. "Just have more faith," he says. What a cruel thing to say. When he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter, John, and James, the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep. She's not dead, but sleeping." Even more insensitive. And they laughed at him. Not a laugh, I suggest, of amusement, but a laugh of contempt. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat. And her parents were amazed. He charged them to tell no one at the time what has happened. Obviously, later they report it, and the news is known and included here. Don't tell us the details, Luke. If you're making up a story, just leave it vague. Don't tell us it was Jairus and specify that he was the ruler of the synagogue. Because the point is, this man is easiest to find, right? You just go to the town and say, "Please, can I speak to the synagogue ruler? Excuse me, did this happen to your daughter?" Now, of course, we can't check, can we? Because it was a long time ago. It was 2,000 years ago. But for the people at the time, these were contemporary events. Luke publishes his book while people are still alive, and they can check. And Luke gives you the times, the places, the witnesses by name, who their parents were, who their children were. It's an easy step to check. And we know there were many hostile to the Christian message in the first centuries who did their best to discredit it. But why couldn't they overturn what the witnesses said? It's not the story you would make up. It's not the story you could make up. And nor is it the story that you would want to make up. See, Christianity didn't make people rich and successful. Maybe it has done since, and there's all sorts of corruption through the ages of the Christian church. But none of the early Christians were rich or successful or politically gained high office. They were persecuted and despised. In fact, Luke has a second volume in the New Testament called the Book of Acts, and he describes the history of the early church. We discover in those chapters imprisonments, beatings, one of Jesus' followers being stoned to death in front of an angry mob, executions by the sword, trials, and yet they stuck to their story. They were stuck to it because they were convinced that they had met somebody who came through the door of history from the outside. Absolutely convinced, because they were there. It wasn't a long, long ago, far, far away fairy story. It was things that they had witnessed, just as I witnessed a high court judge eating a daffodil in a pub in Greenwich. I could tell you exactly when it happened, and so could a whole group of other people. It was witnessed. But actually, I want to tell you one other thing that means I have to adjust my opening illustration, because it actually isn't quite right. This room in which we're here with erased memories asking questions, maybe that's a good fit for our culture, confused as it is, lost and looking for answers. Maybe it describes us. But it actually doesn't describe the people that Jesus first encountered, the Jewish people. Because actually they had very definite ideas about what they were looking for. Now I want to ask you at this stage whether you are even open to the possibility of there being a God such as could intervene in history in this extraordinary way. It might be for some people here, you're just not. You're closed-minded to that. Maybe you've already put your faith, your blind faith, in an atheist view of the world. You think, "I'm here by chance. I can't give an explanation for why I can understand language or consciousness or justice or morality, but that's what I believe, and I won't shift from it or budge from it. And so I don't need to read this book, or if I do read this book, I've pre-decided that it's nonsense because of my existing faith commitment to atheism. If that's you, I'm sorry, you're wasting your time this evening because you've already made up your mind. But for the others in the room, I wonder whether you're even open to the possibility of there being a God of great power who made the world. The kind of God who could, at least in principle, if he wanted to, walk through the door of history. The kind of God who rules the laws of biology and physics, and for whom raising someone from the dead would be unusual, but not beyond his capability. Well, actually, the Jewish people that Jesus first met had exactly these kind of expectations. I just want to read to you from page 25. My aim today is just to give you a flavour of various bits of the story, but from page 25. And the section where it says, messengers from John the Baptist. The disciples of John reported all these things to him. And John, calling two of the disciples to him, sent them to the Lord, to Jesus, saying, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? And when the men had come to him, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? You see, Luke repeats the question for us so that we get that this is the key question. But notice the assumption behind the question. They have existing expectations as a Jewish people. They're waiting for somebody who is to come. They're actually, you might say in my analogy, they're actually, they haven't got erased memories, but they've got a book in their hands. They've got the Jewish scriptures. And the Jewish scriptures contains various promises of a world that was different and better than this world we find ourselves in. A world of healing and life and forgiveness and peace and harmony. There were predictions, very specific predictions, about how this world would be brought about. Someone who would come, a Messiah who would come. And it specified where he would be born, what he would do, the sorts of things he would say. So we have to revise the analogy. Imagine you're just regaining consciousness. But around your tables are books of the Jewish scriptures over which we've been poring all evening. And from time to time, one of us glances at the door, wondering if somebody's about to come in. And if someone does come in, then we immediately evaluate them, thinking, is this the one who was to come? Or should we look for another? Now, some of you, of course, you might think, this is exactly what I feared. It is all wishful thinking. See, they had these expectations. They wanted a Messiah. They wanted to believe in a perfect world with peace and forgiveness and harmony. And so they just persuaded themselves into thinking it happened. Now, actually, they were very, very skeptical and very careful as they watched to see who this Messiah would be. Just look at the question, are you the one who is to come? And the answer comes, in that hour Jesus had healed many people of diseases and plagues and evil spirits. And on many who were blind he bestowed sight. And he answered them, go and tell John what you have seen and heard. You see the eyewitness evidence again? The blind received their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who's not offended by me. Actually, what you've got in this book is two kinds of evidence coming together. You've got the eyewitness evidence. Here's a girl who was dead. Jesus said she was asleep. They laughed. And then she gets up again. Here's a blind man. He can't see. Everyone knows he's blind. Jesus touches him. He can see again. Here's a hospital. It's full of people with various diseases. Jesus walks through the hospital. Everyone's walking again. The eyewitness in your face evidence that persuades people that they must have met somebody with divine power. You've got that kind of evidence, eyewitness. You've also got the evidence of fulfilled prophecy. Does this person match the portrait of who we're expecting because of the Jewish scriptures? Does he do the right things? Was he born in the right place? Will he die the right death? Very, very specific prophecies about how the Messiah would die. Can he beat death? And I want to suggest to you that those two bits of evidence taken together are evidence that here is God stepped into history with promises about the future. You see, you might say tonight, look, I don't really care about history. I mean, yeah, maybe Jesus did those things, but why does it matter? It matters because of what he's promised about the future. A better kind of world. A world of peace and forgiveness. An amended, restored relationship with our Creator. A world of unity and harmony. Mended relationships between fractured human beings. And the evidence that this is the man who came to bring it about. And actually through his death and ultimately his death and resurrection, he has the power to fix this world. Could life in this world be different? Yes, says the evidence. Now we're going to be looking at more of this over the week. So tomorrow, if you're able to come back, we're looking at the question of suffering and pain in this world. Hope in a suffering world. I'll be interviewing at the front a couple from this church family who have recently battled cancer while Sarah was pregnant with their second child. We'll be hearing about that experience and what difference being a Christian has made to them. And then on Thursday night, we'll be considering the question of the fractured brokenness of society, particularly as it's fractured along racial lines. I'll be interviewing a professor of history from Oxford whose expertise is in race relations and the whole Black Lives Matter movement and so on. And be hearing his perspective as a Christian on why the gospel is the hope for bringing people together. Then on Sunday, if you're able to join us at one of our guest services here in this building at 10:30, at 4 o'clock or 6 o'clock, we'll be looking at meaning in a temporary world. And I'll be looking specifically at the evidence for Jesus' resurrection and what it has to say about each one of us and our future. So please come back and please continue to think. I really think these things are of sufficient importance that you ought to cancel your diary for the rest of the week. And please come back. I mean, genuinely, if this is true, it's a life-changing message. But as I said at the beginning, my real aim for you this evening is just a modest aim. I hope I persuaded you that you need to read this book. It's of sufficient importance. The claims that are made are of sufficient importance that you ought to take the time to consider the evidence as a thinking adult. Now, to read the whole thing would take you, I don't know, about 2 hours, no more than that. But I'm going to suggest you don't do that and instead take 1 hour to read only chapter one. In other words, read it slowly enough to actually think about what you're reading. And you're welcome to take these away, and so do annotate them and scribble on them, deface them. Why not take it away and annotate it thus? Tick everything you agree with, but a cross next to anything you disagree with, and underline anything you don't understand for chapter one. To take some time to actually think about what's being said. And then ask a Christian, maybe someone who's invited you this evening, if you don't know anyone, then come and see me. And your friend or myself will take you out for coffee. The Christian will pay. There we are, making a promise on their behalf. And just discuss chapter one and your annotations. I agree with this. I didn't like this. I didn't understand that. And maybe the Christian's able to shed some light on it. And if it's a useful experience, then why not do the same for chapter two? If that's useful, do the same for chapter three, up to a maximum of 24 coffees bought for you. For each chapter. So if it's not useful, you just stop there. All you've got to lose is 1 hour of your life and one coffee. But potentially 24 coffees and a changed future forever. I think that's a pretty good deal. Now, it might be at this church, we've been studying various of the biographies of Jesus. I'm speaking about Luke's gospel. Some of the Christians here have studied John's gospel this year in some depth. Others have studied Mark's gospel, so they might have a preference as to which one they would be able to most help you with. But same principle. This is the one with most coffees in it, so I'm going to suggest this one. But ask your friends and say, can we schedule a coffee? In a week's time, I'll spend an hour, I'll read it, and we'll see how it goes. And if it's useful, potentially that trajectory. Because, you know, this just could be true in a world of deception. This could just have a hope for a life in this world that is altogether different. And you know, it might not even be a fairy story. There might be real evidence Please join us tomorrow, join us Thursday, join us Sunday. Take away one of these and read it. Thank you so much for coming.